Lucas on Life.
Hello, welcome to Lucas on Life. I'm Jeff Lucas. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. Thank you for joining me. It's been in the Christian headlines a lot recently. Control, manipulation, narcissism, particularly among leaders. Premier Christianity magazine back in February shared an article where it was suggested that narcissism may be at the root of the woeful disciplinary list and well-published scandals that have come to light over recent years. To that end, ordination selection questions have begun to be revised in hopes of weeding out controlling narcissists drawn to the role of being a priest, vicar, leader. It's so easy to see why such a position would appeal to someone who wants little accountability and a lot of power, control, and attention. And when it comes to feeling like we're in control, let's face it, when a person stands up Sunday by Sunday and makes statements on behalf of the God of the universe, that's a pretty heady place to be. But it's not just leaders that can fall into the trap of becoming controlling. The truth is, we can all do it. And when that happens in friendships, in families, and in local churches, it's a disaster. So tonight, let's talk about control. At first glance, he looked like a perfectly ordinary chap. I had no idea that he was so immensely powerful and actually so gifted at controlling. He'd developed the ability to control an army without so much as a word. No barked commands needed from him, no parade ground yell of intimidation, just a raised eyebrow, a frown, the shake of a head, and they all knew and would respond accordingly. Obedience without question or hesitation. I glanced again. He was the king of that kingdom. Scanning the otherwise responsive congregation as I was preaching, now he stood out like a very sore thumb. Seated six pews back on the left, the place where I later learned he always sits, his pew, he didn't look too happy. Either he was fighting to digest some food that had passed its sell-by date, or he was struggling to agree with what I was saying. Finding his stony expression a little disconcerting, and battling a niggling anxiety that I'd inadvertently uttered something quite heretical, I made the mistake common to many preachers, as I tried in vain to draw him into my sermon. Hoping for the merest hint of a smile or even a nod of affirmation, I looked his way as I spoke, but he just stared straight ahead, arms folded and locked, a grim statue of a man. Then it dawned on me that I was not the only one interested in his expression. A good number of the congregation were listening to me, but had one eye on him. Some were actually leaning forward to catch a glimpse of his reactions. I wondered, why the fascination with him and his facial arrangements? That's when I realized that they, like me, were tensely waiting for a cue. Obviously, quite a significant player in that church, this man's opinion was esteemed, his influence heavy, and so his response to this new speaker, that would be me, it was a matter of great importance to almost everyone in the place. If he looked unamused, then their expressions turned frosty. If he appeared concerned, raising a perturbed eyebrow or offering even a hint of a frown, then where his eyebrows went, others followed. Whatever he did, they followed suit. I guess that if he had smiled, then they would have relaxed, sighed with relief, and maybe smiled too. I said, I guessed, because he never did get around to smiling. Inwardly, I made a diagnosis, which later conversation proved to be right. He was a baron. I've talked earlier about leaders who manipulate and control, but you don't have to be a formally appointed leader to be a baron. Barons are everywhere. You'll find them in every social context, committees, parent-teacher associations, clubs, families, and of course, churches. Barons are control freaks on steroids. They like their coffee, their homes, their marriages, and their churches to be neatly arranged around their preferences, their environment neatly folded to their precise specifications. Some are recognized leaders. Most are not, but all of them certainly know how to get people to follow them. They control. Barons will use a variety of tactics to get exactly what they want. Some are gifted exaggerators spinning stories of mass discontent to create fear. Often they claim to represent the majority, insisting that they have a mandate for their opinion. "Everyone's leaving the church," said one baroness to me. She boasted a PhD in being in control. "Really?" I inquired, genuinely alarmed at the potential exodus, but wanting to know exactly who was about to exit. Maybe I could have a chat with them and resolve some questions, help them through their discontent. "Well," she nodded gravely, as if the place was emptying even as we spoke, "lots of people are leaving this church." "May I inquire as to exactly who is leaving?" I asked. "Well, two or three people," she said. "Well, please tell me who those two or three are," I continued. "Well," she said, "I don't like what's going on here, and if it doesn't change soon, I am leaving the church." Now, don't judge me, but I resisted the temptation to do a little joyful dance. Some control by undisguised bullying. If they're leaders, they hiss that any dissent is divisive disloyalty and that an opinion contrary to theirs is a betrayal, an insult to their integrity. The accusation, "You're a threat to our unity," is as devastatingly effective as "You're a witch" is to an unfortunate soul who is strapped into a ducking stool by a river. Still, other barons use quiet, meek stealth, controlling as they don an apparently fragile demeanor. Concerned that confronting them would destroy them, everyone creeps around them, and the sound of crunchy eggshells underfoot is absolutely deafening. And then there are the baronial control freaks who use syrupy pleasantness to get their way. They smile. They seem impossibly kind. To cross them would feel quite wrong. So nice are they. But behind that smarmy grin might be a calculating mind. And then church barons, well, they have the ultimate weapon, be they leaders or members of the congregation. It's the G factor, G standing for God. When control freaks produce the God card from up their sleeve, they usually hold a winning hand. When you insist that God has spoken to you, or that you're surely representing what he thinks, you play the ultimate ace card. Few can challenge you, and those that do don't stand much chance of winning. But even though barons may be powerful, they're not usually brave in battle. When they're in danger of losing an argument, they often cancel the conversation by jumping up and walking out. This is an ingenious device because it gives the impression that they're being highly principled in their retreat when they're actually just running for cover. So what if it's a cowardly stunt? Whatever works. Barons. Perhaps you know one. Perhaps you are one. Meanwhile, back at the church where I was preaching, the baron sat rigidly unmoved and the people around him were becoming tenser by the moment. Seeing this bizarre scenario playing out before me, I momentarily considered confronting the situation head on by sharing an old chestnut. Knock, knock. Who's there? Control freak. And quickly now, you're supposed to say, control freak who? But then I looked at his narrowed eyes, his set jaw, and then at those who sat pensively around him, totally under his control. And I thought better of it. We're talking about control, manipulation, even narcissism. I'm not terribly good at hobbies. It's not just that when I relax, I feel guilty, or because as a hopeless quickaholic, I'm so addicted to rush and activity that I just can't easily settle into play. It's more that my personality demands that I throw myself into any new interest with wild abandon. And then I get bored, and then I abandon the new pursuit totally. So it was with scuba diving. I loved the beauty of the crystal clear waters, the fun of avoiding the gaping jaws of moray eels, the majestic gliding of giant sea turtles. I loved it so much that I considered diving as an occupation and was even thumbing through magazines pondering ads for North Sea oil rig divers, while my wife Kay looked on with a wry smile. She knew that my obsession would last just a few days, and then I'd move on. And I did. But I have never yet moved on to golf. Hoping that I might stay interested for longer than a month, Kay followed up my first visit to a golf course where I played with a group of Japanese golfers who spoke no English, which was a blessing, seeing as I ruined their game with my golfing ineptitude. She gave me a gift of golf lessons. The certificate still sits in my bedside cabinet, the lessons unclaimed 20 years later. Now, it's not just because I'm rubbish at golf. Mine is not a swing, it's more a spasm. And it's not that I think it's ultimately pointless to spend all day trying to use a stick to nudge a ball into a hole, or even more tiringly, 18 consecutive holes while avoiding sandpits. Most sports involve doing useless things expertly and in the shortest time possible, so that's not the reason for my golf loathing. No, the roots of my disdain are to be found in my childhood. My trauma is superficial. My mother didn't run off in an electric cart with a chap who was wearing check trousers. They're driving off into the sunset, limited by the 15-mile-an-hour capacity of the electric vehicle. Rather, my aversion is due to a rather painful collision between me and a golf ball. While camping with my family on the side of a course, must get round to asking why we did that, I was walking between the tee and the green when the white cannonball struck me. Now, I'm too gentlemanly to specifically describe the area of my body that took the hit from the golf ball, but let's just say that the arrival of our first child was greeted with great joy and relief. This was a shot below the belt, literally. Ouch. And so I tend to avoid golf courses. Now, what's all of this got to do with control and manipulation? Sometimes those who control, they take shots below the belt too. Sometimes I'm tempted to not only avoid golf courses, but some churches too, because I've taken a few more direct hits, involved as I've been in church leadership. We Christians are passionate people, blessed with opinions. Sometimes we Christians disagree. Sometimes we squabble. Now, disagreement is inevitable, and actually, it's healthy. It's proof that we're not in a cult, which is good. But surely we should disagree agreeably and commit to fight fairly. I've witnessed a few bare-knuckle cage fights where the saints have gone marching in with hobnail boots. The Apostle Paul had scars that proved his faithful apostleship. I'm short on scars, but like most, have had a few bruises, not least from controlling people. Christians fight dirty when we make impossible demands that can never be met, as did the lady who insisted that our church wasn't loving enough, a charge that was difficult to evaluate because there's no measuring instrument available. But she used that accusation in an attempt to control. Talking about being a loving enough church, even if we did get a bad reading on the non-existent loveometer, what was I as the minister to do about it? I can hardly sprinkle Lucas's secret lovey-dovey dust over the congregation while they're not looking. She seemed blissfully unaware that her own lack of love and grace was not exactly helping us in our so-called love score. But she continued to try to control. And then another controlling kidney punch is the accusation that the teaching in the church isn't deep enough. What exactly is deep preaching? Does deep mean that Tom Wright has been often quoted, that a grainy image of an ancient Mesopotamian tablet has been flashed up on PowerPoint, and that the sermon has been sprinkled with a few Greek words other than kebab? Some Christians seem to think that deep teaching happens when they don't understand what on earth the speaker is talking about, as if their confusion is a sign that they are truly connecting with the transcendental. On the other hand, if a complicated idea is presented clearly, they are tempted to believe that the content is lightweight and the speaker is too. Thus, the better the teacher you are, the more likely you are to be accused of not being deep because you're gifted to make the complex accessible. There's no way to win when that kind of controlling attitude prevails. Another jab in the solar plexus is the "lots of people agree on this" jibe. When people control by falsely suggesting that they're representing the opinions of everybody, we're in trouble. But the knockout punch is thrown when we have a fight and we insist that God is the one who agrees with us. He's on our side, in our corner. When we thoughtlessly lob phrases around like, God has told me, God is with me, God agrees with me, or bizarrely, God likes the worship music that I like, we throw firebombs of control that usually turn a small spat into a world war. Before, we were having a rational discussion. But now, in disagreeing with our opinion, others are forced to imply that they don't think we've heard from God and that we may well be self-deceived. Now, dissenters become enemies. Calm conversation is rendered impossible. Sadly, too often leaders are the ones who resort to this form of controlling warfare. Feeling insecure, some leaders are too lazy to allow healthy discussion when members of their congregation ask even the most reasonable questions. Suddenly, the innocent inquirer is tagged as being difficult, awkward, or, I mentioned it earlier, worse still, divisive, a threat to the unity of the church. Yes, that witch burning is in the offing. This is actually cowardly behavior, and it's so unnecessary. It would be so much easier to treat the question and the questioner with respect and perhaps even make an attempt at an answer. So if we have to fight, let's fight nicely. Let's recognize that in our own personalities, perhaps there is a desire to control, to have things our way. With that in mind, I'd like to suggest a new practice when the church starts to feel like a golf driving range. Sometimes we say amen when we agree. So why not yell four when someone drives an unfair and dangerous verbal shot? That way, everyone will know that it's time to duck. Or maybe quickly climb into a pair of armor-plated pants. So as we've been talking about control tonight, let's resist the temptation to think about others, perhaps in our local church, who might be guilty of control freakery. Why don't we ask the Lord, search my heart and see if there be any controlling way in me. See you next time.
Lucas on Life.